From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why your favorite brand of booze might not be on the store shelf. We look at what's behind Michigan's liquor shortage. Plus, UAW rank and file members watch and worry as the federal corruption probe casts its cloud over top leaders.
It makes it very hard for a lot of UAW members to feel confident about the union at the moment.
But we can't just let those few things take out everything good that the UAW does.
Troubled water. What's wrong with what we drink? A clean water advocate sounds the alarm in his new book.
We have a broken water program in the United States. The EPA is asleep at the switch. Our individual utilities are some doing a good job, but in the main, they are not.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Most of us don't think twice about turning on the kitchen faucet and getting a glass of water to drink. But for an increasing number of communities across Michigan and the country, that is not the case.
Whether it's lead or PFAS or other contaminants, most everybody's drinking water in the United States has contaminants in them.
The author of Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink, later in the program. But first, just in time for Thanksgiving and the big December holidays, Michigan's got a liquor shortage. The problem is with the largest of the three Michigan companies authorized to distribute liquor in our state. Republic National Distributing Company recently moved to a new warehouse in Livonia, and that has messed up its deliveries and led to stock shortages at bars and stores around the state. Well, the company says it'll stop taking orders for the end of the week in order to dig out from under its problems, but also said it could take several weeks before liquor deliveries are back to normal. So, let's look at Michigan's liquor delivery system and how the moving woes of one company messed up delivery of booze all around the state. With us now is Tori Rocca, former state senator and chair of the Senate Regulatory Reform Committee, and Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Great to have you both with us. You know, we're not talking about small potatoes, wink, wink, distilled spirits.
Yeah.
Michigan Liquor Control
Vodka
Commission
jokes.
Says it added up to nearly $1.5 billion last year. Lots riding on this. So, Rick, how come bars and stores are having trouble getting their liquor orders?
I think that you explained it pretty well at the top of the segment, Cindy, which is that because of a computer malfunction, that the system for ordering and getting these orders shipped out messed up, and so now that Republic is not keeping track. It did not have all the orders in hand that it needed to fill, and so now they're trying to work their way around that and then get everything get everything back on track. Obviously, the businesses that rely on this, not to mention the customers, are pretty upset because this is lost money to them.
And especially leading into this time of the year. Tori, this seems to center on something called the three-tier system. Tell us what that is.
So the three-tier system is the system, and it tends to be more associated with beer and wine than liquor, because the system for distributing liquor is a bit different in Michigan than for beer and wine. But the three-tiered system, when we refer to that, tends to mean the system by which we separate the manufacturer sale and alcohol, manufacturer distribution and retail sale of alcohol into those three tiers. So we have a manufacturing tier, brewers and wineries. We have a distribution tier, basically the people who own the trucks and the warehouses that ship them to bars and restaurants and stores. And we have the retail tier, which is bars, restaurants, and stores where people go to buy their alcohol.
Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna jump in here for just a second and explain. If it seems weird, it's because it kind of is, but this system dates back to Prohibition. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that once Prohibition was repealed, then in order to avoid market dominance and corruption, that every tier of the three-tier system was going to be separate, and that was supposed to help keep organized crime out of it and things like that post-Prohibition.
So we're talking almost a century old, this system.
Yeah. And actually, it does seem unusual, and it's something that before I started serving in office over 15 years ago, I wasn't even aware of. But it's something that is actually fairly common around the country. It was fairly commonly adopted as a system after Prohibition. The federal government left alcohol regulation mainly to the states, and the states adopted these systems for some of the reasons that Rick mentioned, crime and things like that. But part of it is one of the concerns was something called vertical monopolies, where you have, say, manufacturers trying to exercise control over distributors, or manufacturers trying to exercise control over retailers. So, for example, you may have a large brewer that tries to go to local bars and try to pressure them to only sell their products. In fact, I think the distributors in Michigan right now, the people with the trucks who drive the beer and wine to stores and bars and restaurants, I think they're having an issue like that right now with some manufacturers who are trying to exert some pressure on them to try and squeeze out some of the craft brewers. So in a system where you don't have the separation of these different tiers, you might not, in my opinion at least, you might not see the sort of flourishing craft beer industry we have in Michigan, where you have something that sort of protects the little guys who are just up and coming and making beer from the big guys, the big brewers, because they do have a lot more market power and the ability to influence retailers if they're allowed to.
And Tori, you said liquor distribution works a little bit differently from beer and wine. So what does that mean, and how does that play into what we're seeing right now with the Republic National Distributing Company?
It's because technically all the liquor is sold by the state in Michigan. So it's sold through the state. We don't have state-owned liquor stores like some states do, but we have state-designated distributors who distribute liquor, and basically the state is technically the person who sells the liquor, but of course these actual distributors are the ones who bring it to stores.
But
I know a guy.
Yeah, so.
We're seeing with Republic, are we seeing across the board, is it beer, wine, and liquor problems, or is it mainly booze?
I think just liquor with Republic, and I'm a little removed from this issue directly. I've only been reading about it, because I'm not directly involved in regulation of it anymore. But it's liquor with them, and Republic is they're a significant distributor of high end spirits around the country, and of course they're one of the ones who is designated to distribute spirits in Michigan. And I think there are three companies in Michigan that do this. So if you have one that's not working, then that's a big problem.
And it's the biggest of the three too.
And we should point out that one of the reasons that they're able to maintain this small group is able to maintain control over the system is because they're there's a lot of money in it, and because there's a lot of money in it, it's a powerful lobby in Lansing.
Okay. This is a jump ball question for whoever wants that. The Michigan Liquor Control Commission has stepped into this and told Republic National Distributing, in essence, get your act together and fast. Is there an or else behind that? Does anyone know?
Yes, they have set the, warned Republic that, like you said, to get their act together. But they also say that this is the board's the commission's action, but not something that has been in. Well, Republic has said this is what our plan is. The commission has said, okay, we see what your plan is. But the commission is also saying, but we're not endorsing this plan. And so it almost seems to have that feel of, you're a parent, I'm a parent. And we have that experience of, okay, kids, you're going to do this or else. And if we get challenged on that, we'd better have an or else. And we don't know what this or else is.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly what small steps or small punishments the commission can mete out. I suppose the big or else could be, eventually we find a different distributor if this sort of thing keeps up. Now, I don't think Republic National
they're licensed.
I don't think they would let that get a thing like that get this far over a warehouse issue. My guess is they'll have things under control soonish, but several weeks does sound like a long time for this. They definitely don't want to let this linger on, because they don't have any guarantee that they will always be the distributor in the state. So they definitely would like to resolve this quickly. So.
And there's certainly no shortage of angry bar owners and store owners who are really looking at this time of the year.
I was going to say, we're going into the holiday season, office parties, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, that this is stock up time.
Well, and this could make some people's year financially. This could be for some people, the difference between being profitable for a year or not, depending on how much they depend on this season.
Does our three-tier system, does it leave weaknesses that could lead to more pitfalls like we're seeing now, or do you think this is a fluke, Tory?
I would say it's a fluke. I spent 14 years in the legislature, and 10 of those chairing either the House or Senate Regulatory Reform Committee, which is a committee that handles the alcohol legislation, and I can't recall seeing anything like this happening in the 14 years that I was doing that kind of work, or the 10 years that I was more heavily involved in alcohol regulation. So I would assume it's a fluke, because I haven't seen this sort of thing. And as far as the other types of alcohol, beer and wine, there are dozens of distributors for that in the state, not just three. So it's definitely a lot more diffused and spread out. If something like this happened with one distributor, given the much greater number of distributors for beer and wine, then there wouldn't be a widespread problem like this necessarily. But when you have only three distributors for liquor and the largest one having these issues, that's definitely going to be noticed. But I do think it's likely a fluke. I haven't seen anything like this happen that I can recall during all my time in office.
The fact that it happens obviously indicates that there's a weakness. And one of the complaints about the three-tier system is that that one of the tiers is so dominated by a small group. But I mean, Tory's correct that this also has not been a common issue, and the proof may be in whether or not we see this happening more and more. And I would not be surprised if this lingers on, in particular, if we didn't see the legislature take a closer look at what ought to be done to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, and Tory Rock, a former Republican state senator. Thank you to both of you for being with us on Stateside, and we'll keep an eye on this booze situation around the state. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Thank you.
Coming up, just how are the rank-and-file members of the United Auto Workers Union reacting to the federal corruption probe of their top union leaders?
It makes it very hard for a lot of UAW members to, feel confident about the union at the moment.
We'll speak with two Michigan union members after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A needed economic boost from the state, or corporate cronyism at its worst? That is the debate over a business tax incentive program called Good Jobs for Michigan. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us to dig into the debate, which you wrote about this week, Daniel. So start with the what. Just what is the Good Jobs for Michigan program?
It's a state incentive program that rewards companies, or in fact allows companies, I should say, to capture a portion, in most cases, a portion of the state income tax paid by new hires in a business. So if you're already employing 100 people in a city of Detroit, let's say, and you want to expand your business, or you have a large ticket that you want to bring, the additional jobs that are created as part of that are the ones that where the income tax can be diverted, not the existing jobs. So in a lot of cases, the theory goes that this should be a net gain, that these are new jobs that wouldn't otherwise be created. Now, one of the huge debates, of course, is businesses in many cases are already going to make those decisions, and that the incentives are just gravy. Now, the question it becomes is how true is that, or how not true it is?
Yeah. You know, as I kind of looked at the Good Jobs for Michigan website, and I do see they have to be, a fairly large number of jobs, and also they have to pay pretty good, like at least 100% or more of the regional average wage.
That's right, and it really depends upon what bracket you're in, your project would be in, determines how much you could capture of those income taxes, and how much would then accrue to the state. I think one of the arguments here, and people get really, really intense about this, is that these businesses, as one person wrote to me, are stealing money from children, school funds. I look at that and I struggle with that a little bit, because you could argue that if these projects don't happen, they don't create incremental income tax revenue, so there's none. Anything that you have that is in addition to that can be beneficial, and that money, portion of that money can go into public coffers. A portion of it is captured by the business that's investing. But there are a lot of people that look at this and think this is crony capitalism. They look at people like Dan Gilbert, the Illiches, who I think are in two different camps, by the way, in terms of how they've approached incentives, and auto companies that are investing. Ford Motor Company buys the Michigan Central Depot. I remember when Bill Ford told me that they were going to do this, one of the first things out of his mouth is, and we will seek incentives. So, I mean, this is kind of part of the lexicon right now. And the question is whether they're going to renew this or allow it to lapse.
When does it expire?
I'm not sure, but to be honest with you.
There is a sunset clause, yeah.
Yes, and it is active right now. I believe the Senate has passed it, and it's over in the House.
Okay.
In terms of where it stands at this point.
As you say, you've been hearing from people since your piece came out earlier this week. And, you know, you got to note that under Governor Snyder, there was a huge shift of the tax burden from corporations onto individuals. I mean, we saw corporate taxes dropping by $1.2 billion. That was like more than 57%. Personal individual tax revenues went up by $2.5 billion in the same time. I think a lot of people feel that business got enough love from Lansing.
Yeah, and that's a debate. And the other debate is whether or not what we're seeing happen in places like Detroit or in the state of Michigan is real and sustainable. Or is it all a big fraud? I've had people suggest to me that this is all just a fraud, that what's happening in Detroit is not real, it's not sustainable, that the investment you're seeing there is something that could disappear like it did in the 90s. I don't happen to agree with that analysis. I think that the city of Detroit is in a much different place after its bankruptcy, after billions and billions of private investment that have gone into the city, and not just from Dan Gilbert, and not just from the Illiches.
Well, in fact, let's jump right here, because you said there's a difference in their approach. And people see the headlines about what has not happened around Little Caesars Arena, that promised District Detroit that the Illiches said there will be housing and retail, and what we see are parking lots. And, you know, they own a lot of property.
You're absolutely right. And I wrote a piece about this whole thing a few months back. In fact, I went and looked at it when I wrote this column for Tuesday. Is the Illiches have created a lot of problems for a lot of other investors, including Gilbert, including GM, including Ford, including FCA. And the list goes on and on and on, because they didn't do what they said they were going to do. And they certainly didn't do it in the time frame that people expected them to do it. Now, if they say, well, we'll do it farther down the road, and that's not going to cut it with a lot of people. But as a result, there's a lot of skepticism. And people, I think, are right to be skeptical when they look at what the Illiches did or did not do. And then they question whether, well, is Gilbert going to deliver? Is FCA going to deliver? Is Ford going to deliver? I personally think that the business culture of the leaders today in Detroit is much more about do what you say you're going to do. And I think if you put the Illiches aside, in general, you're seeing more of that. I mean, the projects with Ford are moving ahead. FCA is moving ahead. The Gilbert project, the big one on the Hudson's Block, a little slow, no question about it. But Dan has had a bit of a detour that he's had to deal with, and his whole organization has had to deal with. That is kind of TBD at this point in terms of the pace in which it's going. But I acknowledge the skepticism. I can understand why people need to be skeptical. But we are at a time right now that we haven't seen in Detroit in at least 50 years. In terms of investment and people moving into the city in various parts of the city, it's been a positive. I mean, I think that's one of the things that makes this more enduring is if you have people that are actually living in the downtown area where, you know, 10 years ago you didn't. You didn't have nearly as many, I should say.
So how do we distinguish between tax incentives for business that do what they're supposed to do and hold corporations to account if they don't fulfill their promises, and the ones that seem to just offer businesses tax breaks without getting the public any benefits?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, one of the things my colleague Nolan Finley's written a lot about the Illiches and been very, very hard-nosed about it. And he's talked to the mayor about it. And the mayor's approach is, well, it wasn't our administration. We didn't do it. And I think that's a cautionary tale. And I think the legislature, no matter what they do, they need to make sure they have accountability measures put into these things. You don't get the benefit until you make the investment, until you create the jobs. You have to deliver on what you say you're going to deliver in order to get us to support you, to help you make these deals pencil. One of the arguments is that investing in Detroit is still a bit of a reach. Now, it depends upon the business you're talking about. You know, an auto plant is one thing. A retail operation is another. I mean, it really depends upon what you're trying to do, or the kind of thing that the Illiches have done. This big mixed-use retail village, whatever the heck it's going to be, that's a whole other kettle of fish. So, but you talk to the Gilbert people, and they will tell you that a lot of the projects in Detroit still don't quite pencil, that it's as expensive to build something like the Hudson's Project in Detroit as it is in Chicago. But labor rates are higher. There's much greater demand. It is not as easy to do as it may have been 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years ago.
Bottom line, last few seconds, what do you see happening if Good Jobs for Michigan is allowed to lapse? What's at stake?
That's a great question. You know, for the skeptics, I would say, okay, let's let it lapse and let's see what happens. Let's see what projects don't get done. I mean, is that a double negative? You don't know something that didn't get done if it doesn't get announced because nobody ever does it. I think it's a tool in the toolbox. And the final point I would make is we don't live in an ideal world. In an ideal world, states wouldn't have to pay businesses to invest. But the reality is that there are states, rival states to Michigan, that will pay and do pay a lot. Now, is that the only reason that a business decides to invest? I think the answer is no. It has to do with labor availability and expertise and a whole lot of other, there's a long list of things. But it can be a major decider going forward. And I think that's really the thing people have to grapple with.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Hollis. Thanks, Daniel.
You bet.
Not everyone who's watching business in the economy has the same take on tax incentives. MSU economist Charlie Ballard says he's skeptical of whether they're fair or effective.
Why does this company get a break and everybody else doesn't? If you look at the companies that are given these big tax breaks, what do they all have in common? They're all big operations that will lead to a photo op and a press release.
We'll hear more from Charlie Ballard Monday on Stateside. Rebuilding trust. That's the focus of the United Auto Workers union leadership in the face of the widening federal corruption probe. On Wednesday, acting UAW President Rory Gamble unveiled a series of reforms in an effort to earn back the trust, especially among rank-and-file members. To get a sense of just how much work the union's leadership has ahead of it, we're joined now by two UAW members. Nicole Henning works at GM's Lansing Delta Township Assembly Plant. She is a member of UAW Local 602. Willie Holmes is president of UAW Local 167 in West Michigan, where he works at GM's Parts Plant in Wyoming. Both of you, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
So as you've both watched headline after headline coming out about this federal corruption probe, and you're reading about leaders indicted and accused of embezzling member dues, your dues, and splashing out for rounds of golf and private villas and expensive cigars, how do you feel about those leaders, Nicole?
It's disappointing. We elect leaders in positions to represent our UAW as a whole. And they're put in those positions to do what they think is best for our UAW as a whole. So when they do things that jeopardize our image or jeopardize the trust of our members, it's really disappointing.
How have you been feeling, Willie?
It's very, very disappointing, and it's very disheartening to, like you said, read one headline after the other, and they're going down the list. And, of course, myself being a president, I'm a little bit closer to the top. So I'm at these, you know, meetings and whatnot of the upper echelon at times. And you sit there and you wonder to yourself, now these guys are leading us and they're leading this membership. But at the same time, they're taking liberties with our dues. And a lot of people feel like that we've just been like snowed or been taken advantage of. So it makes it very hard for a lot of UAW members to like feel confident about the union at the moment.
And that's what I wondered. Certainly, you see the names that have been in the stories. And I'm wondering if that uncertainty and disappointment translates into your union. I mean, have these indictments of these top leaders, has it shaken your faith in your union, Willie?
It hasn't shaken my faith, but I'll tell you an interesting little story here. Now, we just ended this 40-day strike. And in my membership at my plant, I had a member who absolutely refused to join the union. And I would always ask him why. And, you know, he had his theories and his beliefs and whatnot. And to me, they are all kind of like conspiracy theories, whatever. But, you know, he was a UAW family. His parents worked there as well. but he refused to join the union. He said, I won't join the union until they clean it up. Well, when Jim announced the strike, this member, who almost knocked me over when he walked in the union hall and said, okay, now I'm ready to join back up in the union. I said, why? It's because finally we're getting our just dues as members because they're cleaning house. So when he said that to me, I sat there and I thought, you know, he's actually right. And I just wondered to myself, how many other members throughout the UAW feel the same way?
And certainly when I spoke with your new acting president, Rory Gamble, he was very clear when we talked last week that he is ready to implement reform steps. Are you prepared to give Rory Gamble your trust, Nicole, as he steps in to clean house?
I think I am. It's one of those situations where you can't let one person ruin it for everybody. There's always going to be, unfortunately, in a lot of situations, there's one person that can take advantage of things if they have the opportunity. So the fact that International is publicly said that we do have a problem and that this is something that we need to fix is a good step in the right direction, because the first step is acknowledging that you have a problem. So for him to come in and say, this is what's going on, and these are steps we're going to take, and a lot of the steps that they're trying to implement will create a lot more transparency for our members. There won't be so many walls as to what's going on, which is what a lot of people have concerns about too, is because a lot of people are like, we don't necessarily know where our money's going. We don't know what they're doing. So I think to build members' trust again, they have to implement what they need to do to show that they're willing to change.
Willie Holmes, you're president of Local 167. How can local leaders provide a different narrative, something that can offset the kinds of activities that we're hearing about at the upper levels that triggered this corruption probe?
Well, the cause is, like I said, as being a president, I get to go to Detroit, and I'm privy to these meetings and whatnot. Well, now, when you're president, your membership relies on you as president and your bargaining chair to represent them and the local. So when we go to Detroit, I'm not going for myself. I'm going for the 800-some-odd employees that I have here at the GMCH plant that put their trust in me to, you know, bring them back the facts, whatever they may be. So now that we have this corruption going on, every time we go to Detroit and I come back, these members are unbelievably engaged, and they really, really want to know, what did we learn? What did we find out? What were we told? And you asked the question about, you know, has the trust been earned? And right now, if you ask members of my unit, the answer will probably be no, because, like I said, the headlines, and I don't know if the people say, you know, don't believe everything you read, but when you kind of got the inside track and then you know that the headline is relatively close to being the truth, they wonder, what are we doing? I mean, the strike was a testimony to the membership, because it was the membership that decided this strike. It wasn't the leadership for once. It was actually the membership that decided this strike. So as president at that point, I was proud to be president, because I thought to myself, well, now these members will really truly understand what it means to be engaged with your union, not only from a local standpoint, but from an international level as well.
Nicole, for the public, people outside of the world of the United Auto Workers Union, and they see stories of the corruption probe and one leader after another being scooped up in this, what story is not being told about the union? What do you want people to understand about your union?
I want people to understand that our union isn't just the people at the top. It's not just the people that we elect to represent us. Our union is all of us. Every member that pays union dues, every person that stands up and volunteers in the community, I mean, if we let just one person or a few people in their actions speak for the entire membership, it's going to give us a very bad image. And unfortunately, it's in the public right now, we don't have the greatest image, especially with this going on. So it's important for our members to talk to these people that hear these things in the media, because sometimes they're not always true, you know, especially like during the strike. I had a lot of conversations with people that heard about things in the media that were untrue or it didn't tell the whole story. So it's important for our members to explain to people that this is happening and this is something that we're dealing with as a unit, but we can't just let those few things take out everything good that the UAW does.
Willie Holmes, how worried are you about a federal takeover of your union?
Extremely concerned. that the government got involved in our union. Because, like she just said, our union isn't just the people at the top. Our union are the members, the people that come in here every day and push these buttons and make these parts and assemble these cars. We're the actual union. All the things that we do, all our good works throughout the community, that is what our union is all about. The corruption at the top, just like any big corporation or anything else, there's always corruption somewhere. The only thing I'm glad about is the fact that it's finally being cleaned up. And I think that once we get it cleaned up and the general public realizes who we are and what we stand for, you know, we'll probably have more support. Because even during the strikes, I mean, we actually got heckled by people. I found that very disheartening. And then, of course, you know, myself being a president and on the local news, people would see my face. And then I'd be out in the grocery store at the gym and somebody go, oh, what are you guys going on strike for? You already make all this money. It's not about the money. It's about the people. So if the federal government gets involved, I myself would be very, very leery.
Willie Holmes, president of UAW Local 167 in West Michigan, and Nicole Henning, who is with UAW Local 602 in the Lansing area. Thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Coming up, we expect the water coming out of our tap to be safe to drink. But for an increasing number of communities across Michigan and the country, that just is not the case.
Drinking water in the United States is the most significant and least discussed public health threat of our time.
We'll hear about the threats to clean drinking water from PFAS to lead and more. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Used to be, you didn't think twice about opening the faucet, filling up a glass of water, brushing your teeth, filling the kettle. The Flint water crisis showed us clean drinking water is not something that we can take for granted. And it hasn't stopped with Flint. Latest water samples put St. Clair Shores on the growing list of Michigan communities with high levels of lead. Other areas in our state are worrying about PFAS contamination in their groundwater. And it is no surprise to author Seth Siegel. His new book, Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink? Seth Siegel, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. Great to be on your show. And thank you for your leadership on covering water stories in a field in which very few people do.
Well, we certainly learned from the coverage that Michigan Radio did of the Flint water crisis. You know, we talk about water problems, and that does... It tends to be on the forefront of people's minds. As Flint unfolded, were you surprised?
I was surprised mostly by the fact that people were surprised, if I can put it that way, because it's quite clear that whether it's lead or PFAS or other contaminants, most everybody's drinking water in the United States has contaminants in them. And my issue, as you know from my book, is not about any one specific system, although I think we have to address it system by system. My problem is that we have a broken water program in the United States. The EPA is asleep at the switch. Our individual utilities are some doing a good job, but in the main, they are not.
And I want to have us talk about some of those factors. But just hearkening to Flint, what lessons should we take away from what happened in Flint? What do you see as the do's and the don'ts?
Well, the first thing you want to do is, and unfortunately, people got motivated only when they thought their careers were coming to an end or they might be going to jail. But the first thing you need to do is you need to start being honest about the testing. We need to use more technology. We need to be on top of problems so that we can address them before they become a crisis. The nice thing about water problems are almost always that they give you a long warning signal before they burst into your face. Whether it's a water main that breaks, whether it's PFAS, whether it's lead in the water, any one of these things, almost all of them are predictable based upon conditions at hand. And therefore, that's what I said, that what surprised me most about Flint was that people were surprised.
And we saw, for example, during 2015 into 2016, you had all the presidential candidates making their way to Flint. You had a lot of national media attention in Flint. And that isn't happening anymore. But people in Flint are still lining up to get bottled water. And I wonder, do you think the lessons that we should have taken away from Flint have been heard? Are they being applied elsewhere in the country?
I think it's hit or miss from what I can tell. I speak to lots of public officials. I speak to communities all around the country. I think that sometimes you have either enlightened public officials or you sometimes have frightened public officials who don't want to be the next poster child for bad governance. But frankly, no, I don't think it's enough. I think that we don't yet have a national conversation about water. And it's really a shame because drinking water in the United States is the most significant and least discussed public health threat of our time. And it's all the more tragic because we can fix the problem with existing technology and at affordable prices. And I think that that is the scandal that we have in front of us.
And certainly as well as lead, here in Michigan, and as we see in your book, Troubled Water, across the country, communities are discovering groundwater contaminated by that family of chemicals, commonly known as PFAS. What do you think, Seth Siegel, the eventual scope of PFAS contamination is going to be for our country?
Well, it's hard to say definitively, but the early signs are that it's going to be a real national problem because just in the last couple of days in New Jersey, they came up with results that basically all of the public utilities there were forced by state law, not by federal law, to do PFAS testing. And guess what? At 517 out of something like 517 of them that were tested, they found PFAS contamination.
What are the big challenges that we face in not only identifying but cleaning up PFAS sites? I mean, the nature of that chemical makes it awfully durable.
Yeah, but the way to treat it is not to treat it by digging out all these groundwater sites and purifying them. The cost of that would be unimaginably gigantic, and there's no way that the corporations and the federal government, where they were liable for the contamination, are going to take that kind of responsibility. So the answer has to be at treatment and filtration, either if not at the source, then before it gets into people's homes. And that's basically the plan that I lay out in Troubled Water, is that we have the means for doing this. As the water gets drawn out of the groundwater, you filter it through very inexpensive, basically, filtration devices, GAC it's called, and then you clean the water of all the PFAS that are getting into people's water right now and threatening their health. For those of your listeners who don't know the consequences, PFAS just sounds like, you know, something mm-hmm. out of a laboratory, but it has real-world consequences. As I talk about in detail in my book, and tragically, it results in cases of kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis. Women who are pregnant have very dire consequences from health effects when they have high PFAS in their bodies. And what's not made clear, I think, enough is the fact that PFAS is a chemical that doesn't just come and then go. It comes and it's just like lead. It stays in your body and it has a durable, long-term bioaccumulative effect. Very, very frightening.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with author Seth Siegel about America's drinking water crisis. His latest book is Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. You know, in talking about the Flint water crisis, Seth, and similar issues in D.C., you point out how the actions of a few individuals made a big difference. But all through your book, you show us that these water issues are massive and the result of a huge array of different factors, from the EPA to state and local governments, massive corporations. And it makes individuals' actions kind of seem like a drop in the bucket overall. I mean, is there anything individual people can actually do to make a difference?
Well, I think that's exactly why I wrote the book. I didn't write the book just to sell books or to tell a story. I wrote the book really as a cry for action by individual citizens. And what I have discovered, and I report on this a bit in the book, is that every time there has been a significant step forward in drinking water quality and safety, every single time, it comes about as a result of consumers, ordinary folks, becoming frightened about what comes out of their tap and demanding better. And that goes back to 1912, when there was the very first federal water law passed, to as recently as our laws, the Safe Drinking Water Act. When citizens become engaged, when they demand better, there is a result. And the good news, as I said earlier, is that this is a problem that can actually go away. How many other environmental or public health crises that we have can we say definitively that we know that we can fix the problem? This is one that can be fixed.
We certainly saw that in Flint, citizen activists who didn't take the state's reassurances there's nothing wrong with the water and went to, for example, Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech and took it on themselves. So, yes, we certainly saw that play out.
But we also see the fact that whether it's the EPA or whether it's most of the time state authorities or public or sometimes even private utilities, is that nobody is taking it seriously because the concept is it's legal. It's legal. We're following the regulations and the laws as set forth. But the problem is, and here's the mantra that we need to say to everybody, is that legal does not mean that it's safe. Let me share with you what I think is among the most compelling statistics. There are about 120,000 chemicals of different kinds, pharmaceuticals, plastics, industrial solvents, and so forth, that are in commerce on a daily basis in the United States. 120,000. So you would think that an intelligent system would be regulating or supervising or testing or monitoring, oh, I don't know, 75% of them, 90% of them, half of them, something like that, right?
Right.
Okay, so the actual number, there are 70 chemicals that are regulated by the EPA right now. And if that number itself doesn't make you crazy, because it made me crazy, and it was that fact that got me to start researching that became the book, the second fact is the one that absolutely tipped me into saying, okay, I'm not going to devote a couple of years of my life to getting this story told. And the second figure is the last time the EPA regulated any chemical was 23 years ago. So explain to me, explain to anybody how it's possible that in an industrial society like ours, where every year there are 3,000 to 5,000 new chemicals or pharmaceutical products being added, many of which get into our water flow, that we haven't found a single one that's a threat, including, by the way, PFAS.
And you dig into the ways the EPA is caught in you portray this tug of war between public health and economic growth.
Even economic growth. I wish it were as simple as that, because then I could actually find myself saying, well, okay, I buy into the idea of economic growth. It isn't economic growth. That's traditionally the way the environmental debate is framed, right? Whether it's, you know, it's better for the environment or better for industry. That's really not the story here. The story here is that you have an unwieldy, huge, crazy, proliferated number of public water utilities or general utilities in the United States. We should have about 200 to 300 utilities to manage all of the drinking water in the United States. That would be a sane, manageable number. Instead, we have, hold on to this, you're not going to believe this, we have 51,535 separate drinking water utilities in the United States, plus another about 107,000 separate water systems. We'll put those aside for a second, because those are like universities, churches, campgrounds. Put those aside, even though those are regulated as well.
Sure.
But you have 51,000 plus utilities. Most of them are too small, too underfunded to do what they have to do. And because of this gigantic number of utilities, there's almost no way that the EPA can regulate them all. But the big problem becomes, and this becomes a bipartisan failure, we think of this as partisan, but it's not, it's bipartisan, is what happens is whether Democratic or Republican, you have all these small towns and some larger towns, and even within Los Angeles County, you have 200 drinking water utilities. And what happens is the congressperson comes home for the weekend, and because people aren't yet saying to them, I want my drinking water to be made clean, safe, healthy, and assured that I can drink it without any threat, they're not the ones talking to the congresspeople. The ones talking to the congresspeople are the utility owners or the public utilities themselves. And so they say, don't burden us with new regulation. Keep the EPA off our back. So what we have is we have a system where we have these 70 regulated chemicals, 91 contaminants altogether regulated, but that's all there is. And the utilities do not want to see new ones regulated. And we have a second problem, which is that we know for a fact that amongst those 70 that are regulated, some of them are not being regulated at the right level. For example, arsenic, which is a big problem in many, many parts of the United States. The federal government, the EPA, regulates it at something called 10 parts per billion. I don't have to explain what that is. Just say it's a number.
Yeah.
The correct number, most scientists agree, should be somewhere between 3 parts per billion and 5 parts per billion. So how did we get to 10? The answer, and I set this out in my book, is it was a completely political decision. Everyone knew the science, but because so many extra utilities would be caught by going from 10 parts per billion down to 5 or 3, the Clinton administration made the decision, a Democratic administration, makes the decision on political grounds not to have to jam down a better, higher standard that would be more protective of public health. That, to my mind, is exactly what the problem is. The decision is not being made by scientists. The decision has been made by politicians who are trying to take the path of least resistance and not antagonizing the largest number of people possible.
And that's why regulations keep falling short.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk a little about solutions, Seth, especially considering Michigan, our access to the Great Lakes, and the many diverse rural and urban communities that we have in our state. What kind of solutions do you think could matter most to Michigan?
Well, what I think you need to start seeing is first of all, is a national mindset, because this breaks down to, there's obviously many parts of the problem, but it breaks down to three basic problems areas. Number one is that the manpower needed to run a modern, technologically sophisticated drinking water system is in disarray. We have an aging water workforce, and in many, many communities, they can't even attract a single engineer to come in to work there because they don't have enough money to pay them or it's too remote. So the first problem is manpower. The second problem is technologies. You have all kinds of great technologies that are now at hand and available, but now on the one side, the EPA doesn't demand that it be used necessarily. And on the other hand, again, these smaller utilities, of which there are tens of thousands, don't have the funds to fix and pick up the newest technologies. And the third part, which I think has gotten some publicity, is broken water mains. And we have about 1.1 million miles of water mains in the country. They are very aged. Last year, there were 240,000 water main breaks in America, leading to huge amounts of water losses, huge amounts of carbon fuels being wasted because that water had to be transported. And we need to fix all three of these parts. We need to have a better manpower. We need to have more technology. We need to fix our broken infrastructure. Now, some of that is particular to Michigan and the people who are listening to us right now, but mostly these are problems that are national in scope, and therefore I call upon a completely new approach to all of this. Number one is we should stop thinking about fixing our pipes in terms of fixing them all today. This is a 25 to 30-year project that can be financed over 50 to 75 years because pipes last a long time. Number two is if we could reduce the number of utilities that we have down to a manageable number, we'd be able to have the population large enough to hire engineers and to buy the technologies needed to fix the problems. And so by having a more financially, fiscally sound drinking water system, whether public utility or privately held, I'm completely agnostic as to which one, by having fewer of them, you can have a far better outcome for everybody.
What will it take to convince the policymakers and also the public?
I know exactly what the answer is. People have to get angry. People have to demand a change. And again, I will tell you that time after time in America, we see that this happens. I have a historical vignette to share with you. In 1962, a woman named Rachel Carson, who may be known to some of your listeners, wrote a book called Silent Spring. There actually wasn't an environmental movement yet. There was conservation organizations. There didn't exist environmentalism yet. She writes the book. It becomes a significant book. People start talking about it. And the book was talking about pesticides, not about water. And people got agitated about this. In 8 years, without social media, in 8 years, we had our first Earth Day. First Earth Day. Now, why is that significant? In April 22nd, 1970, 40% of all Americans, students, homemakers, workers, retirees, 40% take time off from whatever they're doing to participate in one or more Earth Day activities. But one person who did not participate in those activities was a man named Richard Nixon, who at the time was president, who also instructed his White House staff that no one should participate in Earth Day activities. April 22nd, 1970. Okay, December 2nd, 1970, less than 8 months later, Richard Nixon, no one's idea of an environmentalist, but a smart politician, by executive order creates the EPA. Now, that kind of energy comes from the fact that he saw where the public was going and he needed to get ahead of it. All of the special interests, all the utilities, all these congressmen and congresswomen who don't want to do anything to upset their friends will change on a dime as soon as your listeners start demanding change, because that's what has happened again and again and again with every passage of every Safer Drinking Water Act.
Seth Siegel, his new book is Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. Seth, it was great talking with you. We want to thank you for spending time with us.
Cindy, thanks so much, and thank you for helping to spread the word about this, and thank you for your ongoing work in this important area of drinking water in America.
And we always love to hear from you. What stories or people are you focused on, or issues that you want to hear more about? Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. On tomorrow's Stateside, there's growing concern about pollution from farms, from nitrogen pollution in Lake Erie to livestock waste and pesticides. Farmers are realizing some changes need to happen.
Our goal is more to have an impact on the farm and to have an impact on the community and the watershed that they're in. We have to remember these folks live where they work, and they want to do the best things.
On the next Stateside, we'll talk about making farms more environmentally friendly. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, Tad Davis, Adam Reyes, and Bella Isaacs Thomas. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.